I don't even know the intersection, because really I know about zero about quantum optics. But sort of cold atoms, optical lattices, and there the optics is completely classical. I know something about it. So I figured I'll just give an overview of the type of stuff that I and people like me do kind of generally. So basically, let me start with the ingredients. We use, first of all, light plus atoms. And in the simplest picture, you've got some atom that has two or more levels in we shine light on. And you can get spontaneous emission into the unoccupied vacuum modes. And that can be used for cooling, detection, that kind of thing. But also, you have stimulated processes, like if you're detuned. And that'll shift down or up the energies involved in a second order process. Just, you know, you absorb and stimulate a photon back, and that causes induced dipole shift in the atom. Okay. And we use that for trapping, detection, and control of the atom. So now, in addition, these ground states are can have structure, hyperfine structure. And those are usually really quite coherent, and they, you know, have range from, you know, 10 gigahertz down to, if there's Amon levels that are split, you can basically drive that to zero.
And this is kind of, these two energy scales are kind of the basis behind all the ion traps and what you're
doing. Yeah, so this energy scale is, you know, 10 to the 15 hertz or something. It's, you know, it ranges from infrared to UV. And this is actually one point when talking to John that I think is a little bit, I usually think of all these quantum systems as identical. You know, they're all quantum systems, and our system's exactly yours, and you can map the language. One thing that is a little different is I don't think there is the equivalent of this high energy scale in some of the, for example, some of the solid states. I mean, like quantum dots will have some optical things that go on. But like for the qubits and things, there isn't this equivalent thing, you know, floating around. Okay. So, and the processes that are the resonant processes tend to scale like 1 over delta squared, where delta is the detuning from the resonance that you're on. And then these stimulated processes, being second order, tend to scale as 1 over delta. Okay. And so what that basically means is for example, if you want to make a potential by shifting these ground state energies, then if you just have more power and detune farther, you can make this shrink faster than that. And so you can make an essentially conservative potential. And so you can make, right, a potential that looks like a scalar potential. And it's proportional to the intensity of the light, and that's what we use for the trapping. But it turns out, if this ground state has some structure, and this is actually another language from atomic physics that people use, is that when they say ground state, they mean a whole bunch of ground states, basically all the hyperfine ground states and all those Amon levels. I found that confusing because they're, you know, it's not the ground state, right? Even if. So anyway, but if the ground state has structure, then it turns out that the potential doesn't just have to be scalar. It can have the interaction can have a vector part, and this is proportional to the intensity and the ellipticity of the light. And then there's a tensor part too. And that, you know, this is going to look like a Zeeman shift, so it's going to be proportional to the m of the Zeeman level. And then this will be proportional to m squared, or at least the linear tensor part. There's a lot more structure to that. And that actually can be useful, and, we've done a number of things with that. I can give an example of this. The simplest example is if I have two laser beams counterpropagating, I can get an interference pattern of the intensity, and I get basically a lattice. This is all the work that, you know, a lot of people have done, putting cold atoms in lattices. And that's the scalar part. And I've drawn this if the polarizations of the two beams are the same. If I were to have two beams where the polarization, one is coming out of the plane and one is perpendicular to it, so-called Lin-perp-Lin polarization arrangement. Well, since these two E fields for the traveling waves are orthogonal, there's no intensity pattern at all. So the intensity is just going to be flat. But there is a polarization lattice, and it's because they're counterpropagating, they have a phase relationship that changes as you go through. So at one point, there will be, I'm not sure how to draw it, but at 45 degrees, linear polarization at 45 degrees. You go a little bit farther, and you'll have right circularly polarized light. And then a little bit farther, there's linear polarization opposite 45 degrees. And then you'll have, let's draw that the opposite way, left polarized, circularly polarized light. And it reproduces. It's periodic that way. And because this vector shift is proportional to the ellipticity, it's exactly like having a little magnetic field that points in opposite directions along the beam with a periodicity of lambda over 4, lambda over 2 in this case. And that can be used to control the atoms and, you know, differentiate atoms among the different Zeeman levels. And it can also be used to shift atoms depending on their state. And there was a very famous result from Emanuel Bloch, where they took the atoms, put them in a superposition of two spin states, and then by rotating the polarization from this configuration to the other configuration, you can actually split the state-dependent lattices. So this I've drawn kind of in this vector, this local magnetic field picture, but you can also draw it for what does an m equal plus 1 atom see, and it'll see an effective lattice that looks like that, and the m equals, you know, minus 1 atom would then see something that looks like that. And you can move around and play with shifting the different internal spin degrees of freedom spatially from each other. Okay. So this, when I say an effective magnetic field, a lot of times the condensed matter people get really excited, and you know, they start talking about orbital fields, and there's a communication mismatch. When I say effective magnetic field, I mean an effective magnetic field for a neutral atom. Namely, it produces Zeeman shifts, but there's no gauge field or anything associated with it. But if you want to go beyond that, you can. This is where it's short. It's probably. If you want to go beyond that, there are ideas to use the ground state structure in the atoms to produce effective orbital fields. And there are a variety of proposals for it. The mental way I view them is basically, if you've got an internal, internal state structure, by changing the spin state, you can sort of make it as if you go uphill both ways. Namely, you go around the loop and you essentially go uphill the entire way. For a scalar potential, you can't do that, but for if you change the internal state, you can sort of go uphill in one internal state, flip, and go uphill in the other internal state, and then flip back, and you're where you were, and you will have picked up a phase proportional to your area, which is basically what a B field is. And an example, and this paper, I remember it was from Fleischauer, and I can't remember the rest of the guys on it. But to me, it's one of the simplest examples. You take two laser beams, and you aim them at each other, but they have different profiles that are offset from each other, like that. And the two laser beams are arranged in a lambda configuration to couple two internal states. And if the atoms are sitting in a dark state, which is the right superposition to basically be dark, and the population in the two states is inversely proportional to the ratios of these intensities for the dark state, then, and let me draw this out, so this looks like that, you know, moving that way, and this looks like that, moving that way, the profiles are supposed to be non-overlapping. Well, if you look, the dark state phase depends on the relative phase between the laser beams, and since they're counterpropagating, the phase changes as you move through, and it changes here as you move through as well. So the dark state will, if an atom moves along this direction, it will pick up a phase, and then if you just went straight back, then it would undo the phase that it picked up, but it turns out that if you then move along here, you change the relative intensity of the relative beams, and then you also change the relative population here. Now if you come back, you pick up effectively a baryphase, and that baryphase will be proportional to the area, and so it looks just like a charge in a magnetic field, not just a fictitious magnetic field for neutral particles. And there are a variety of ideas using lattices and Raman coupling different lattices, and so things spin flip as they jump from site to site. But in all of them, you know, the idea is to pick up a phase if you go around a loop where the phase is proportional to the area. And in all of them, of course, the claims, at least in the descriptions, that you can get into interesting, you know, high field correlated physics, quantum Hall type physics. Okay, so that's kind of the tools and the types of things that we can do. Let's make sure I
can you do that in a lattice structure?
You can do that in a lattice. The you would just superimpose the light fields on top of it. So, I mean, one of the things I didn't talk about is there are other tricks that people do in the lattices. So if these two beams are coherent, they're a standing wave, changing the detuning, the lattices can move because, you know, the standing wave, if there's a detuning between them, you'll have a moving standing wave. Another trick that people do is that if I have two of these lattices and I detune them far from each other, and by far I mean farther than, say, a typical vibrational period or a band spacing period in this lattice, there will be cross interference terms. Those cross interference terms go so fast the atoms just time average over it. And so you can coherently add lattices to get interference, but you can also incoherently add them. So just by detuning them from each other, and the atoms can't follow. So for this case, if the dressing beams that are making this fictitious field and the lattice beams are far detuned from each other, and far is not actually that far, in these cases it's tens of megahertz, the atoms won't follow that motion at all. And that can be independent of some other lattice, as long as it doesn't hit some Raman transitions or anything. Okay, so
in this question. So, I mean, has it been done experimentally?
This has,
the lattice case.
Which lattice case?
I mean, have you tried to generate orbital magnetic fields in it?
No, the only.
In the lattice?
No, the only fictitious. It hadn't even been done, to my knowledge, other than rotation, you know, rotating cold atoms and using that. In the rotating frame is a fictitious magnetic field. It hasn't been done with neutral atoms. But I think, I mean, this is the problem with a lot of the proposals is, you know, every week there's, you know, 10 new proposals of doing something, and you sit down, and like, that's really exciting, and everybody's going to love it. And then you start working through the details, and they're all doable. Some of these, like this one, is extremely doable, and I'm surprised it hasn't been done yet. But a lot of them are, you know, quite challenging to make all of the little things work out. So another thing I wanted to point out, let's make sure I've got all my...
Is the challenge because you have all these laser beams and you have to get it set up right, and it's, you know, takes some time to do that, makes some effort?
No, I mean, the laser side of stuff is pretty trivial. Like making the lattice is trivial. You just point two laser beams and vacuum at each other and you get it. Okay. The hard part is getting the cold atoms in there, making sure they're cold enough. If you're doing things, you know, like some of these lattice examples involve tilting a lattice exactly so, and then Raman coupling things in a tilted lattice, and you know they're talking very small shifts, and then you
have to do everything right.
You have to do everything right, right? It's all doable. It's all engineering. I mean, that's one thing I would say about these systems, particularly for doing quantum information type things, is. And maybe I'm going out on a limb, but the Hamiltonian is completely known. And all of the parts of the Hamiltonian are completely known. In fact, if we find dirt in our system, it's probably like a major new physics discovery. It's not, we just know everything. The question is, given the limitations of that known Hamiltonian, can we do the things that we want to do? I'll give another example that is less condensed matter. Oriented and more quantum information oriented that we're, you know, looking to do, and we've actually done a minor version of it already, is that, you know, you can not only do this as a condensed matter system, but if the lattice is deep and you've got atoms trapped in these sites, you know, you can view this as a nice register for atoms. And one of the big issues that people talked about was, how do you address these things? This spacing here is lambda over 2, and that's well below the diffraction limit, even of really, really high numerical aperture optics. But the diffraction limit is not a fundamental limit for imaging something because it's contingent on a specific wavelength of light. I mean, there's nothing fundamental about the diffraction limit for detecting a particle. Unless you restrict yourself to, I'm only imaging and I'm going to form an image. In fact, the fundamental limit is the uncertainty limit of how localized the thing is. You ought to be able to detect the thing. And so a simple example was if you had a gigantic gradient field, you could do NMR on it and find a position in, you know, basic frequency. It turns out that the gradient field is gigantic, and you know it causes all kinds of problems. However, I just said that this is an effective magnetic field, and it can have structure as small as wavelength of light. So if you come in with, let's say, a pretty good tweezer, but it's not at the diffraction limit here, and it has a strictly vector, it's circularly polarized, so it has you arrange it to have a vector light shift, well, then you can dress the potential for another internal state to look, say, something like this. And these atoms you arrange so they don't see this shift. They're in a effective M equals zero state or something like that. I mean, but you can play around with it. You have a lot of flexibility to adjust the scalar and the vector part. And then you can come in and frequency address those guys. And the real limit there is it you trade in a resolution limit for a time limit. Basically, the speed at which you can do this has to do with how big a spacing you can get those. And you know that's all doable. I think it's reasonable. The real issue then comes an engineering issue of registering a tweezer to a lattice. You know, this is going to be 400 nanometers apart. I think it's a very doable thing. You just have to, which we intend to do. Attack the problem of actually making that well registered. But then you have to ask all of the fundamental questions of, we know the spontaneous scattering rate, how for this tweezer, and there's something I glossed over, which is to get this vector shift, you have to be slightly closer detuned. Basically, if you get it through a spin orbit interaction. And so you have to be close within the fine structure of the atom. And so that sets a different scattering limit. That for the optical lattice, you can detune really, really far and essentially turn spontaneous emission completely off. I mean, it's close to completely off if you want. But for this, you can't. And so you know you have to work through a lot of details. Like, I turn this on, I do this flip, and then turn it back off. You know, how much error do I get in that amount of time? But that's an example of the type of thing that you can do, you know, using just the light. Now, I should say, we've done light trapping And part of the reason is our attraction to the fact that there is no dirt. There's a whole neutral atom community doing stuff on chip traps and using, you know, all kinds of lithographic techniques and microcavities and small things like that. And I think there's a lot of promise in that area, but there's also a lot of dirt. And if you look at what people have done, I mean, some really good things are coming along, but there was a lot of dirt problems to solve first. And one of the things I find attractive is that the stuff we do, and people like us, is that the atoms are, you know, in vacuum. There's nothing in the vacuum. We don't have feed-throughs, we don't have it. And so, like, if you talk about one over F noise, that kind of thing, we do have one over F noise because it's ubiquitous, but it's all outside the vacuum, and anything outside the vacuum is classical, and you just feedback. You know, if you've got classical one over F noise, you just feedback it away. And so, you know, amplitude stabilities and things like that, if you feedback on that, you know, it makes life easy. Now, I'm making it sound great, but I think I'm the most pessimistic guy about any of these schemes in the room, at least based on like talk with people. I'll tell you what I think the difficulties with neutral atoms are later on. Okay, so we have a real eraser. This thing is just
these words there.
Okay. So then the other ingredient that you need to do anything interesting is interactions. And this is one of the more challenging things for neutral atoms. And that is that the interactions are incredibly weak, right? They're neutral, so they don't interact much. And I mean, they have magnetic moments, so you have that. But they're actually quite small. And that's, I guess, the yin and yang. As Ivan Deutsch says, of these things, is you want them not to interact very much, but then you want them to interact a whole lot. So the, for us, the most common one is a point contact interaction that is on a molecular link scale. Namely, the two things, they're neutral, they have to get close to enough to each other to actually have, you know, atomic wave function overlap at the molecular level so they can see an interaction. And for all intents and purposes, although my NIST molecular or atomic collision theory people always disagree with me, it's a delta function interaction. And they'll like argue forever that it's subtly not, whatever, and then you tell them, well, under these parameters that I'm doing my experiment, can I just replace the interaction with a delta function? And they'll say yes, you can. So it's basically a delta function. And the scattering for most of what people do is S-wave, although people have done things, you know, P-wave all the way up to the G-wave. You know, you can see higher partial waves, but of course they're massively suppressed at these low temperatures.
What do you mean delta function? I mean, if you bring a closure together, I would expect a step function rather than a delta function.
It's a delta function in 3D position space. Basically, they have to be, if I have...
Well, then you'll never get them to interact in 3D.
Well, you have
1D
to...
1D delta function, yeah, but in 3D, I mean, they're going to miss how you get everything aligned. So that they...
Basically, if you want to calculate the interaction of two particles, it's essentially a wave function overlap. So if you do the integral properly, you have to get all the delta function normalization right. Basically, it looks like the integral of the densities of the two.
Oh, okay. So you take the width of the atom.
You take the width of the atom.
And then it's just an overlap.
Right, it's just overlap. That actually makes... It's the full atom wave function. So like if they're sitting in the thing...
It's an experiment.
It's an experiment. Well,
the interaction is delta.
The interaction is delta.
Yeah.
In position. Right. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Well, the reason I bring it up is it's insanely useful, and it basically puts our local theorists out of business, because we can calculate everything that we need to calculate now, and it's really useful. It does, however, have the drawback that it's not at a distance. If the two atoms are in separate wells and there's no wave function on it, there's no interaction. And that's true to pretty high accuracy for a lot of the neutral atoms that we use. The dipole-dipole interactions from the spin is really tiny, quite extremely tiny. Okay. So then there is, and I should also say that this interaction strength is also controllable to a large degree if you find a Feshbach resonance. And that's basically the two incoming zero energy plane waves, or low energy plane waves of the two atoms, that energy becomes resonant with some bound state in a different internal state in some closed channel. And due to the interaction with that other state, the effective strength of this scattering resonance can be tuned with a magnetic field, or sometimes using light, like light shifts and optically. And so you can get order of magnitude, maybe pushing two orders of magnitude change in the strength of that actual interaction. And you can do it dynamically. That's one other thing I didn't, well, I'll maybe draw a list of things that are sort of different from some condensed matter things later on. Well, there's a lot to be desired for this. You get it for free, and that's what we use because we like it. There are other ideas, such as induced dipole interactions. And the idea here is the ground states of two atoms that are separated in space from each other don't interact. But some excited state might have a reasonable induced dipole. And so if you can excite up to this, and you have a small electric field to provide the choice to have a dipole, then these two things might interact very strongly. And the example for this, as with like practically everything, comes from Serac and Zoller. I think Steve Rolston and I think maybe Dieter Jacques was on this as well. And there you excite the atoms, and then they do have a long-range interaction. It can be reasonably strong. And it's controllable. You turn it on and then turn it off.
So what range are we doing now?
Okay, so I'll give a whole list of energy scales later on to give a scale. But the general thing for cold atoms is take every energy scale you know and then just shrink them by several orders of magnitude, and you have our energy scales. But the good thing is you shrunk everything together, so it looks just like condensed matter systems typically. So I'll talk about energy scales. But these interactions can be multiple gigahertz. And the on-site interaction for two wave functions in the same lattice site is in the several kilohertz range. So very small. But, this always, weirds people out and freaks them out. Oh, that's tiny, tiny. But every energy is that slow. So it's just, a slower time scale. Maybe you're not going to run a computer, at 1,000 times faster than what we do. But if you get exponential speed up, what's a factor of 1,000?
Is there a temperature in the phone?
There is a temperature. I'll talk about temperature as well, too. But it tends to typically be also... That's right. Otherwise, you're lost. It tends to also have been scaled down. So, in fact, if I could find an energy unit that people were not comfortable with, it would be just fine, right? If I had some random other energy unit that people weren't converting through, I could just do the whole thing, and everyone would say, "Oh, yeah, that seems familiar to me." Okay.
What is the energy scale of the excited state? Yeah?
So these excited states would be like the Rydberg levels, and it's just going to be massively large. So basically, tens of eV. And that's actually one of the major issues with this kind of, I'm supposed to lift the rug, but I would be lifting the rug every 2 seconds if I went into detail of all of the problems of everything that might show up, is that these do have a lifetime, and you have to be able to do these processes faster than they're going to decay. There's a lot of energy that might want to come out of the system, and you have to work through to make sure you can actually do it. There are fundamental fidelities in the system. Okay. Another example that's been really popular lately is ground state dipoles. And you can't get an electric dipole out of an atom, but if you have a polar molecule, you can get. And so this would be polar molecules, and they can have huge interactions that stretch microns easily. And then also people have been doing just larger magnetic dipole. And in those cases, the dipole interaction goes with mu squared between two dipoles. And so even, you know, there are some atoms that have been cooled and trapped that have six times the six mu b instead of one, which most of the atoms we have. And that's something that's 36 times stronger interaction. And that begins to actually be large enough that it starts competing with the normal contact molecular interaction. But the polar molecules, again, have really huge ones. They can have, you know, gigahertz range interactions.
In the case of the polar molecules, you presumably need your electric interaction with the external field to be large or comparable to the rotational field.
Right.
How large an electric field does that have in practice?
It depends completely on the polar molecule, there are a wide variety of ideas that try to use the entire, like fully polarized, and then there's some that use not fully polarized, and then there's some that do dynamic things where you don't actually, these systems have so little dissipation and decay, or can, you do dynamic things where you basically pulse, you do like a pi over two pulse to put the thing into a superposition of the two states, and then work in the rotating frame, and then you do have this large dipole when you there. So sometimes it will take large, field. All of them are completely experimentally accessible fields. The other issue with dipoles is that, of course, their interaction, you either need to have them in the lattice. I actually didn't mean to go into this, but you either have them in a lattice and you do some way to keep them, because they have a nice, strong repulsive interaction if you go like this. But if you bring them like this, they're incredibly attractive, and they'll suck each other in. So you typically have to combine them pretty tightly in a plane or some kind of geometry to keep them from wanting to pop onto each other like that. But, you know, there are a lot of ideas that I'm not going to.
Just in general, you were kind of scornful yesterday about the idea of polar molecules. I mean, I understand they're very complicated and they're hard to track
right.
And cool, and it's all very intimidating. But in the long run, as an idea theorist, it sounds like a great idea.
So scornful, I hope it wasn't taken as scornful. I'm not scornful. And I probably shouldn't say this, I'm inherently a lazy person, and I like low fruit. And particularly if there's something to be learned and some interesting physics. And polar molecules is a huge payoff, but it's a big mountain. And I think it's just really challenging. And the real issue comes down to there's a growing class of laser coolable neutral atoms. And maybe I should have this discussion when I start talking about energy scales. Laser cooling with those atoms works really well. But for the vast majority of matter out there, laser cooling doesn't work very well. And there are no good schemes for doing it. Polar molecules is an example, and people are trying every single possible thing they can to get these things cold. And you want them in their ground state, too, because if they're in the excited state, there's just tons of bad energy to be had that they'll collide and spray out a lot of energy. And one of the approaches is laser cool atoms that make polar molecules, get them cold, and then photosatiate them or do a Feshbach sweep or something like that. And then other people are trying other techniques. And I think the laser cooling ones are probably the closest, but they're the least general, because you're stuck with what atoms that you can laser cool. The other techniques are great, and I think there will be a lot of payoff, but they are orders of magnitude away from the densities and temperatures and things that you would need to get into this regime.
What are so great about polar molecules again?
Basically, because you can arrange that they'll have an electric dipole moment. And electric a big one, right? Or
so then
I don't want to say permanent, because then Bill, if I say permanent, Bill jumps all over me, grabs. So you can never have a permanent blah blah blah. But you can basically get them to have a permanent dipole, and so then they have a long range.
So you basically want them to interact strongly.
You want them to interact strongly and at a distance.
Yeah, and right? Then that, of course, is the problem, too.
That can be the problem, too. For example,
that's the normal story here.
That's right. That's right. But for example, neutral atoms, the hyperfine structure is like 10 gigahertz. Normally, that would couple to blackbody radiation. But the coupling is just so incredibly weak that there's just no coupling. And you can put the thing in there, and there's no coupling to the fact that the room is sitting at 300 Kelvin. I mean, when we give these really low temperatures, the atoms are massively out of equilibrium with the radiation field around them, right? That's because the interaction is weak. These guys, however, have electric dipole moments connecting some of them, and so they're going to couple to blackbody radiation. And I haven't seen too much analysis of that, but and when I mention it, people say, "Oh, it's not too bad," or you know, "Cool down your, you know, do your thing in a cryostat or something like that." So,
what's the energy scale for just the qubit, for example?
Splitting. The splitting?
Yeah.
Again, that depends, but I think that depending on whether they're using a rotational level or a spin level, that can be gigahertz to multiple tens of gigahertz, you know, pushing into 100 gigahertz kind of range. I don't actually, polar molecules is not my area. I've just sort of, you know, skimmed the abstract and gone to a few talks. Okay. I mean, I think this is great, the type of stuff they can do. In fact, these interactions are so strong that if you confine the atoms to a plane, you don't even need a lattice anymore. They'll form their own lattice, because they and the lattice can be really small spacing because the interactions are strong enough to do that. Okay. So maybe I'll...
So how do you turn on and off the interaction?
Okay, so in this case, this interaction would always be on. A lot of the ideas with polar molecules, most of them are in the sort of condensed matter simulation realm, although there are definitely some for quantum information. And in those cases, you would tend to control action with some frequency tuning mechanism. But there is this very interesting idea, and I am going to give it a very short shrift, which is actually quite interesting using polar molecules, is that using RF coupling and being in the rotating wave, you can arrange it so you can turn off interactions using certain RF couplings to sort of, in the rotated space, sit at magic angles to turn things off. And there's this kind of very interesting scheme that Peter Zoller has for taking, and I think Hans-Peter Buchler is working on this, for taking a lattice system, and by applying the right RF fields, you can actually turn off all two-body interactions, but leave three-body interactions in a lattice. So there are techniques for turning off interactions by applying the right dressing field that essentially will, in some rotation frame, sit something at a magic angle that'll turn it off. But these ideas would be that if you had an atom here and an atom here, you wouldn't get an interaction. But if I put a third atom here, I would get an interaction. So that on a lattice, there'd be some three-body interactions, which apparently people, some theorists are very interested in. Right? It's
isn't that very sensitive to the spacing, and or is that dependent?
Yeah, the interaction will be sensitive to
the turn of the switching, your ability to.
I think it probably is sensitive. I don't know how sensitive it is, but I mean, for us, the spacing is known to many, many digits because it's basically a laser frequency. Okay. It's a real three body interaction, and then it's not two body interactions. It's
three body.
it's, there's nothing there, there's nothing there. And if you have three, it's a, there's a three binding dimension. But you'll have to look at, you know, talk to them or to really know how that works. Okay, so the other thing that's different about our systems typically is that there's typically no dissipation of certain types. So, like, for example, we work essentially at constant magnetism, which is different than a lot of condensed matter systems, because you can give up angular momentum in some way. And for example, if you cool a system, it will a normal system in contact with something else, it'll normally cool to its magnetic ground state. Our systems will relax to a state that has fixed magnetism. There's no way for, if I put the thing in a superposition of spin up and spin down, and I have a whole bunch of atoms trapped in my lattice and it spin up and spin down, there's no way to give up spin, so we work at constant magnetism. Basically, this would be, you know, magnetism zero, and then all the dynamics would be under that constraint. And that happens a lot with our system. And then when I go to talk to condensed matter people and they have ideas of, oh, I'll do this, and this is a difficult, it seems very simple, but it's a difficult constraint to think about sometimes. And another thing is that makes our systems different is we don't have a bath. And I think I'll hold off on that until I talk about probes and temperature. Okay, so, and then the last few things before I talk about the energy scales, which is useful for the light, is that any intensity pattern you make can be a potential. And people haven't exhausted or even tapped into the possibilities, but if you think of holographic techniques, anything within the diffraction limit that you want to make that's a potential for atoms can be made. And people are just starting to do more and more interesting things. So you really can think of making, you know, circuits out of light that you can move atoms around in, or whatever your favorite lattice potential is. You can also, what people are beginning to do is put in disorder. One thing about these systems is when you make these optical lattices, because it's interference and diffraction, there's not much disorder. Typically, you'll have long wavelength disorder, but there's very little short wavelength disorder. And they're pretty clean crystals. But people are now trying to put it in, and they basically use holographically generated speckle patterns with as small a resolution as they can. They put them on top of the lattice, and people are trying to look at Anderson localization and competition with interaction and disorder and that kind of thing. But I think eventually you can do, I mean, if you can think of the pattern and its structures larger than the diffraction limit of your optics, you can make. I think that's a real benefit. And then one other thing that's different from condensed matter world, which is useful for quantum information purposes, is that our lattice is an externally applied potential. It's not an emergent thing that comes about from the interactions in the system. And what that means is there are no phonons. Now, if you put it in a cavity, you can start imagining exchanging photons in the lattice, which will show up in a way that looks like phonons. But the lattice is not an emergent crystal. It's an external potential. And a lot of times that also causes some confusion, because some of the things you think about lattices don't apply. There's no excitation associated with the lattice. And, you know, moving atoms isn't associated with defects or anything like that. The lattice is fixed. And if you have a defect, it's because something's missing. It's not because the lattice itself, you know, managed to get a defect somehow. Okay. I think that's everything on that page. Oh, and then one other thing, because I'm supposed to pull the rug and be honest, I erased it, is that a lot of times you'll see people talk about Feshbach resonances and the ability to control the interactions between the atoms. And particularly theorists, and I'm not trying to be disparaging, but particularly theorists will always answer your question, with a Feshbach you can tune that. But the truth is that near every Feshbach resonance where you have the most sensitive control of the interaction, there are lots of loss processes associated with it. And sometimes they're not bad. And the classic example, all the really recent work being done for example, Ketterly or Christoph Solomon or Randy Hewlett with lithium 7, that happens to be a very good atom where the losses at the Feshbach resonance are not that bad. But most other atoms, many other atoms, like there's a lot of work being done in potassium, the losses are pretty bad there, so you have pretty short lifetimes once you get near there. And that's something that you have to think about.
At Oxford, the rubidium, they're dying with rubidium, and for months the losses used to be drastic. I mean, you couldn't get the liquidity of a number of atoms in that type of resonance. Just add up. So it took like a few months and you couldn't get any good numbers.
Yeah.
Well, usually it's far worse for bosons and fermions. Right?
It's true, but even for the fermions, so like potassium 40 is the example. So for bosons, it's a total disaster usually. I mean, people are talking lifetimes of milliseconds, tens of milliseconds, you know, that kind of thing. For fermions, it's better, but they can also still be bad. And bad in my language, you know, like I talked to Paul Julien, who is doing stuff with the terbium, which is a closed shell. They're very nice, and they should be collisionally very nice. And he was talking about optical Feshbach resonance. And he said, oh, you can do plenty of stuff. I think the lifetime maybe be about 10 milliseconds. And for that stuff we want to do, 10 milliseconds is just not workable at all. So I think, and it also depends on where you are. Potassium, for example, on one side of the Feshbach resonance isn't too bad, but on the other side, or going through it, can get really bad, even though they're fermions. It also depends on what you want. Do you want to hold them for a second? Do you want to hold them for 100 milliseconds? You know. But I'm just.
It's always all a three body process, isn't it?
It's always three body process. So, for example, if somehow, and this is true of these dipolar molecules, is if you put them on a lattice, their two body and three body processes are horrible. You need to be deep into a fermionized or, you know, hardcore boson regime to avoid those losses, which you can do. So, maybe in some of these schemes where if you can eliminate all of the possibilities of three atoms on the same lattice site, then you'll improve, you know, you'll improve these processes. But there's still two-body issues that can come about. Okay. So let me talk about energy scales, because this is actually one of the, I think, difficulties with these systems. So, you know, the strength of the optical lattice depends on the detuning. And in the early days when people were just doing laser cooling and Sisyphus cooling, you know, they would make these optical lattices, and they're fairly near resonance, and you might have an atom in there. And you could typically laser cool this atom. And these lattices, since it depends on detuning 1 over delta, you can make them quite large, and you can get them, you know, notice I used the word large, you know, greater than, much greater than a millikelvin, tens of millikelvins. To me, that's humongous. and you can laser cool the atoms typically into, you know, you can do much better, you can do worse, but I'm going to say sort of in the 50 microkelvin kind of range. The problem is that if you go and you want to make a lattice that doesn't have any spontaneous emission and it's good for doing, for trapping atoms in a register or doing condensed matter stuff, you have to detune far enough, and you don't have of course, if I'm drawing this on this is not the scale, you know, this is 50 microgram, room temperature is sort of way, way, way off the charts. The problem is that given laser powers, given, you know, and there you're going to get, you know, an order of magnitude in laser power, but not, you know, much more, and then it gets scary having these 100-watt lasers around in the lab. The depth of the lattice that you typically have is sort of in the 10 microkelvin range. And this is one of the despite the fact that you have these great laser cooling techniques, and despite the fact that we can actually get temperatures really, really, really low, this actually is one of the limitations, for example, for quantum information. So And it basically, it's because if we want to, when we cool down, so we can get the temperature down, we then just evaporate. So once we trap these atoms and cool them, we evaporate them by throwing away, you know, 0.999 of the atoms, and the remaining 0.1% is actually really cold, and its temperatures can be, you know, they're very hard to measure, but they are basically down at the bottom of this, and they can be, you know, well below a microcal. Well, let's put this. Okay. But, and that's fine. You have a system where you scaled every energy down, the lattice depth here, the vibrational spacings in the lattice, and maybe I should draw it, you know, let's zoom in on the lattice. You know, you have band spacing or vibrational spacing, how you want to view it. The depth might be 10 microkelvin there, and you might have sort of 1 microkelvin, you know, for that. And then you might have a temperature that's down in here that's, you know, below 0.1 microkelvin. And you say, well, that's fine. Just scale all my energies down. The problem is, if you want to do something like, let's say you want to detect this atom, normally, particularly in a material, you don't think about the recoil of the photon in the process of detection. If I go and start doing fluorescence detection on this atom, he heats up because this lattice depth is a finite number of actual photon momentum recoil energies. And so every time I scatter a photon, he heats up and he heats up. And that becomes really hard. Basically, I've got this tiny, tiny, tiny little washboard potential in my atoms are just sort of sitting in. If I want to do something, you tend to heat them out of the lattice. You know, for these static condensed matter things, that doesn't end up being a problem. But it is a limitation for these systems. Okay. If you compare that to ion traps, the ion traps are just, on our scales, insanely deep, kelvins deep. And when they want to go detect something, they just scatter away. Now, they also cool simultaneously, and their idea is to cool simultaneously in these lattices. So for example, Dave Weiss has just recently, I'm not sure if it's out, shown a large period lattice. It's not a short period lattice, but a large period lattice where he laser cools individual atoms in the sites of the lattice and can simultaneously detect them and laser cool them in the individual sites of the lattice. The difference from the type of stuff that we do is those lattices are really big, and there's no way to do contact interaction between them, and he's not sitting at the ground state of each individual lattice site. But there are ways to do the detection. It's just harder than it is with ions. Okay. So let's now say we've cooled down and we have the atoms sitting here. Let me draw a How long am I supposed to go?
I have no problem with that. I don't know. Let's say 15 minutes.
Okay.
Is it fine? Is everyone? Yeah. Is it fine with you?
That's fine with me. I don't know. I mean, I actually, for some reason, thought this was going to go faster, but it's the act of actually writing stuff out. It takes a while. So you have these atoms in the lattice, and depending on the depth of the lattice and the tunneling, you have, you know, the most localized wave functions you can make, sort of line functions for the lattice might look like that in the bottom band, and then, you know, in the next band they might, you know, look something like that. If you look at sort of the two-particle interaction. So you put two atoms on a given site. The two-particle interaction energy, which is usually called U, is going to be on the order of, say, 0.1 microkelvin. And I have to make sure that's right, because I think in kilohertz. And I converted this to this really funny temperature unit. And if you use this basis, the hopping energy, the tunneling energy, is going to be less than or much less than about the same. It can be actually a little bit bigger, but that sort of sets the energy scale for that. And that's fine. I believe the temperatures that people can get to are quite low. You know, they're fractions of this energy. The problem is, if you want to do some of the more interesting correlated many-body physics that people talk about, Hubbard, the interesting parts of Hubbard models, those energies scale with these, you know, it's this correlated physics with your neighbor. So they scale, they're second order processes that scale with, you know, tunneling over your neighbor and coming back. And so they go as t squared over u. And those things, you know, are, you know, 10 to the minus 3 sort of microkelvin range, typically, because this is more frequently in the sort of 0.01 microkelvin range. And that's actually a major challenge, I think, for seeing this kind of physics. And the problem with this is that you have a little bit of flexibility with the interaction strength, but you just have very little flexibility with this tunneling because it's set by the recoil energy of the atom that you've got. You want to go to a lighter atom and you want to go to shorter period lattice, but you just have limitations of what you can do for that. So you can gain a little bit on this, but that's a problem. Well, if you have this sort of setup and you want to use the Vanier basis, then you can start constructing, you know, Hamiltonians in that basis and integrate out the wave function degree of freedom, and you'll get something that has a tunneling term and then an interaction term. And this is the way people usually write it, and it's pretty good. It's a pretty good approximation, but in reality, there actually are, as you can imagine, if this is the Vanier function, there is an overlap interval between nearest neighbor sites just due to this, a square overlap integral. I mean, the functions themselves are orthogonal. And so there'll be a nearest neighbor term as well, and in fact, there are tunneling terms that go, there are two tunneling terms. And then there's also another band completely. This is all in the lowest band, so you'll have, you know, the upper bands. And then it begins to get really potentially complicated because if the interaction is, it usually we assume that the interaction is a lot smaller than, I would call it h bar omega, but it's also the band spacing, where omega is the vibrational spacing in a given lattice, I'd say. But you can discuss it as the band spacing in a lattice. Then you start mixing the bands and all that stuff. Well, usually we just, to a really good approximation, it's kind of amazing. As long as this interaction is smaller than the band spacing, you typically can throw everything out except those terms, well, plus an inhomogeneous term, which is basically the fact that the trap has some, you know, overall harmonic nature, usually, although people are working on making flat on the traps. And, but I just wanted to point out, because a lot of people will say it is, they pretty much say that the cold atoms in the optical lattice is a perfect Hubbard or Bose-Hubbard model. It's not exactly perfect, but it's awfully close, as long as this interaction strength is small. Yeah.
The correction to the Hubbard point is a real solid four-fold wisdom.
Right. Okay. Point taken, but the real reason for studying this system as opposed to a real system is the fact that it's so clean Hubbard, right? I mean, that's the whole selling point. If our system was as dirty as, you know, YVCO, there would be no reason to do this at all. So, but, and then, you know, another thing that makes these systems really interesting is that you can change, you can do lots of flexible things. You can change these to have a dimensionality to be different in the different directions. You can change them dynamically. You can also change the interactions to be state dependent if you add spin to this. So you can add spin to the whole system. I mean, there's a lot of flexibility in constructing a lattice-based Hamiltonian in these systems. Yeah.
May I explain why is it so difficult to measure the properties of the superfluid insulator transition? I mean, as far as I understood experimentally, they see the transition, but they cannot really measure the properties around it.
Right. Well, which properties are you
interested in? The exponents and this type of thing.
Right, right. Well, the exponents are difficult because we have an inhomogeneous system at current. That's the main thing. The other thing is, and I probably won't get to it because I took way longer, is, and this is the point that I'm interested in because I want to get people to help me, you know, develop probes and techniques for studying things. Maybe at a discussion section after the session, I'll bring that up. But it's our probes are very different than typical probes. We did a transport type measurement where we try to move atoms through the lattice, but there are very few of those. I believe Ketterly's just recently done some work, you know, doing transport. And what our probes usually are, which I didn't get to, is usually what we do is we look at direct momentum distributions of the atoms. You snap it off, and then you just watch the atoms fall out, and then you look at what momentum distribution you have. And in a way, that's really interesting because you just cannot do that in condensed matter. And it's sort of direct information somehow about the many-body wave function. The problem is that information sometimes is not particularly revealing or interesting. And so what we typically will see are not many-body transport properties or, you know, susceptibility or, you know, something like that. We tend to see things that are more coherent things. So in your mind, if you draw a difference between a superfluid density and a condensate fraction, for example, which in something like helium-4 are vastly different things, the superfluid density can be 100% and the condensate fraction is like 10 or something like that. We typically will see the condensate fraction.
Well, this means it's totally hopeless to do, for instance, Fourier transform on this and measure the correlation function in real space.
No. So there are techniques, and this is the thing that I want to see more of, and there, I haven't seen that many of them, where you can get out different properties. You can do things like Bragg spectroscopy, and that's basically just like any of the sort of spectroscopic techniques to look at excitations in the system. So if you have atoms in the lattice, you can shine light on them and cause quasi-particle excitations in the system that you then, looking at the response of the system, get information about the many-body spectrum. So all of those kinds of techniques are amenable, and people have done beginnings of that kind of stuff. Transport people are beginning to do more. They're not as clean as you would like because of the inhomogeneous nature.
How do you do it? How do you move atoms?
For what we did is we had the lattice, and the atoms were in the lattice, and then there was a harmonic trap sitting on top of the whole thing. We just shift the harmonic trap, and it just shoves the atoms through the lattice. And then we watch their motion. And the stuff, we did it in 1D, and in 1D you don't expect there to be a sharp transition temperature because the fluctuations in 1D tend to make dissipation occur well before you would get to any mod insulator transition. But I've seen some stuff from Ketterly recently who did it in 3D, and there was a fairly clear change in the dissipation right at where you expect the mod insulator transition to be. So it's a technique that can be used, and I think people should use it more. What I'd like to see is more engineered traps where you actually made it look like a real thing, where you had a reservoir and then some lattice system and then another reservoir, and you tilted it and you just watched stuff move through it. But you know, that's a lot of optical engineering. It's very doable. I think it's, you know, a fair amount of work to make happen. So anyway, I had a lot more discussion, but maybe I won't continue on if I'm gonna there was concern, I think, about the coffee break from yesterday.
I would propose that, I'm interested in this, what kind of probes, experimental probes, you can use in this collateral physics stuff. If everyone is interested, I would propose that this is part of the discussion in the quantum optics thing.
Mind you, nothing I do is quantum off, so.
Well, so if there are questions?
Yes, sir.
There are questions? So I have one question. You mentioned that you can do time dependence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what does it mean exactly, experimentally, you can do time dependence? Can you change u as a function of t?
You can change u.
Regardless of t?
You can if you use a Feshbach resonance. This depends also on the lattice step because of it's an overlap function. You can change t as a function of time just through the lattice depth modulation. So, for example, you know, we do a probe. If I have some many-body state in a lattice, I can change the lattice and completely turn it off. And I can turn it off on several time scales. There's a time scale which is faster than everything, okay? In which case, I take my many-body state and just project it on the plane wave completely, and then I can let them fly apart and take a look at it in time of flight. I can do a time scale that is, let's say, faster than, say, interaction energies, but let's be honest about that, and slower than the vibrational spacing, but it's the band spacing in the lattice. And then what that does is it essentially, it keeps you in the bottom Brillouin zone, but you dynamically adjust the lattice from a lattice to a plane wave. But because the interactions don't have time to readjust anything, it just maps your many-body state into the bottom Brillouin zone. And so it's a way of mapping the many-body quasi-particle states into free particle states. And I can show you some pictures if you want of what it looks like. And that's the gorgeous pictures that people show where the falling atoms fall exactly in the first Brillouin zone. And you can put them into the second Brillouin zone in any given direction and see them. And the distribution in that Brillouin zone is, to a reasonably good approximation, the distribution of the many-body quasi-particle states. Oh, and I should say, I just discovered and found out, to my horror, that the early papers that they did at NIST and laser cooling, they used the term quasi-momentum and claimed that they had gotten that from some condensed matter people. And then Ian Spielman, who just joined our group, a really good guy, he came from 2D electron gas world. I've never heard that. We couldn't find quasi-momentum anywhere, and every textbook said crystal momentum. And I'm hoping they'll find some condensed matter somebody that says, well, yeah, we use quasi-momentum. But apparently, they just made the term up and didn't realize they'd made the term up. So when I say quasi-momentum, I mean crystal momentum. You use it?
Yeah.
OK, so then we looked up like four textbooks, and they all said crystal momentum.
You found it the same thing.
OK. So there's this intermediate time scale that you can turn off from that. And then there's the time scale where you're smaller than all energies. Okay. And then you just map, if you do it perfectly and barring some Kibble-Zurich type problem, you will map ground states to ground states. Okay. But you can also do stuff like modulate the amplitude of the lattice. You can shake it to cause local vibrational excitation or to affect transport. And then when you get much more sophisticated, which is some of the stuff that I won't show now, but was going to show, is we have developed a double well lattice, and so the lattice at least along one direction has a unit cell. And we can change effectively the height of the barrier, the tilt. We can go over to a lattice of that shape that basically has a periodicity of lambda instead of lambda 2. And all of this can be done dynamically on all the three of these timescales. And if you focus on one of these unit cells and you're familiar with like these double quantum dot things, the physics is amazingly similar, other than the fact that we have bosons instead of fermionic electrons. And our interactions are a lot weaker, and the energy scales are all a lot weaker. But it's just like a double quantum dot kind of system. And this kind of thing gives an example of the type of probe that you might be able to envision. And I would like to get more input about, particularly from like the quantum information world, might be able to provide input for the types of probes. Is there's a proposal from Misha Lupin and Eugene Demler and Anna Maria Ray to use the double well, so work mostly in a lattice like this, where you're doing some many-body physics, and then use the double well. If you combine atoms in the right way, you can actually tell the difference if you have some kind of state that's in some kind of correlated state here. You can actually tell if the correlations are singlet or triplet-like between the two wells. Normally, if you're going to use scattering or some kind of spin population, you look for, say, anti-ferromagnetic ordering from scattering or something like this. And if you had like some kind of triplet-type order across here, you wouldn't see any population difference in the spins if you went to look at it on average. But you can actually tell, with this technique, you can tell the phase difference between the two-body part of the state here. So that's the kind of thing that you can do. And you can do all of this dynamically.
Just to reinforce something which you essentially said, this ability to change the interactions drastically over a time scale short compared to the characteristic times of the system, that's a huge difference with most condensed matter systems, and particularly liquid helium. I mean, liquid helium basically would be induced to change the pressure in the millisecond.
Right. And that actually brings to another point that I won't delve into, but I was going to yak about ad infinitum, and that was that I think that one of the interesting, there was a huge explosion of condensed matter people wanting to talk to us, you know, once this field started getting going and they had all these ideas. And they're great ideas, but I think we also need to get some AMO people to pump back some more ideas, because our strengths, if we end up just doing equilibrium stuff and we just make nice clean models that, you know, theorists want, and we just study straight condensed matter physics in these model things, we won't live up to our full potential in these systems. Because these systems have a lot of other advantages, for example, this dynamic control and using more, you know, doing different probes than the traditional probe. And in addition, because it's so dissipation-free, there's a whole world of non-equilibrium physics that I think we can, you know, have access to and look at. And there's a lot of very interesting things sort of that are in this strongly non-equilibrium regime that you know, we can study and look at. And I mean, for example, this very interesting stuff that Dave Wise has done in 1D systems, where he has atoms in a 1D system, and since it's in their delta function repulsive interaction, since it's integrable, they don't actually equilibrate. And questions about the quantum version of the KM theorem and like what it takes to make them equilibrate, and if you turn on a little bit of tunneling to the neighboring systems. I mean, those are questions that I don't think you can get at in of many other experimental systems, and I think you can in this.
So, further questions? So, you're not in the thing.